Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi, filling in for John Tanza here in Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan, and the rest of the region this Tuesday, October 15th, 2024. Ahead of World Hunger Day, there are warnings of a severe hunger crisis in South Sudan from Badan Owade with the World Food Program.
Almost 7.8 million people are food insecure, facing worse effects of hunger, and therefore require urgent humanitarian support.
And Sudanese journalist Chakunya Keto describes the situation in Sudan.
And there is no food. People are facing hunger. More than 20 million people are actually hurting by hunger and famine because of the war.
We have those stories and more coming up right here on South Sudan in Focus. Stay tuned. The United Nations says there is enough food in the world, but hunger persists for 10% of the planet's population. Experts say South Sudan is one of the most food insecure countries. James Shimanyula reports from Nairobi ahead of World Food Day.
The 2024 Global Hunger Index shows that hunger levels are alarming in six African countries: South Sudan, Burundi, Chad, Madagascar, Somalia, and Yemen. In South Sudan, Africa's newest nation, two-thirds of the 11 million people need humanitarian assistance. Bernard Owade is the World Food Program's lead food security analyst in South Sudan.
South Sudan is facing serious food insecurity. According to the latest food insecurity first classification, almost 7.8 million people are food insecure, facing worse effects of hunger, and therefore require urgent humanitarian support. This is the highest number globally. We're basically talking of more than 60% of the population being in dire need of humanitarian support.
Owade says South Sudan faces several challenges in producing and supplying food.
South Sudan is prone to drought and flooding and has been flooded for the last 4 years. The current conflicts that continue to impact on the population of this country, frequent conflicts, some are ethnic, the difficult economic environment. We have IDPs in camps, we have refugees in camps, largely depends on humanitarian support for their survival.
The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization says 150 countries will observe World Food Day on October 16th to generate awareness about hunger and to encourage actions to ensure food security for all. The latest data on world hunger by the Global Hunger Index, which measures the severity of various hunger indicators, shows the world produces enough food to feed all of its 8 billion people, yet 733 million people go hungry every day. The index indicates hunger rates in Africa are especially high, with 1 out of 5 people going hungry each day. The Integrated Food Face Classification estimates 1.33 million people around the world are experiencing famine or famine-like conditions. Hundreds of thousands of them are in Sudan, where an 18-month-long war has blocked food supplies to parts of the Darfur region. The WFP also has reported alarming levels of hunger in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, where conflict has driven hundreds of thousands of people from their homes, and the drought has led to increasing hunger in parts of Southern Africa, particularly Malawi, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. For VOA Africa, I am James Shimanyula in Nairobi.
Since April 2023, a war has been raging in Sudan between Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and his former deputy, Rapid Support Forces Commander Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. The United Nations reports that over 10 million people, about a fifth of Sudan's population, have been forced from their homes due to the war. Among them is Sudanese journalist Shakur Nyaketo, who fled to Qatar via Ethiopia and Kenya. VOA's Paul Ndiho spoke to Nyaketo about the ongoing conflict in Sudan.
We left the country, we went through different countries. From Sudan, we crossed the border to Ethiopia. From Ethiopia, we went to Kenya. And after maybe 8 months or even more than that, then we made it finally to Qatar. Now we are still looking for actually a place, to settle. Two warring parties are insisting to fight because the Sudanese armed forces decided to end this war militarily, and also the rapid support forces decided to continue on fighting. So this is the reason that why the war age is prolonged. And there were so many different initiatives in Saudi Arabia, and the last one is in Geneva, but they were not able to actually come together. And that's why they are still continuous in their fighting. And the more they fight, the more civilians get affected by it. And also because the army has its own reasons why they don't want to stop the war. They're asking the RSF to actually leave the cities, and they ask them to leave their military bases, and then they have to leave their military artilleries outside the cities and the places where they are. And the RSF is actually rejecting that, and that's why there is a back and forth, fighting.
I'm sure you still have some relatives left in Sudan. When you talk to them, what's the situation like on the ground? How are they able to even to provide for their families when this war is going on?
Very tough humanitarian situation right now. We talk to our families, we talk to people in Sudan. Most of the people are actually facing very big, issues. Family. Right now, especially living, especially, life expenses every day. And there is no food. People are facing hunger. More than 20 million people are actually hurting by hunger and famine because of the war. Either you have a family member outside the country, like in the port or somewhere, they send them money, or they expect the charitable organizations or charitable groups, they are inside there, and then they are providing food for the people, but nobody is able to actually provide for themselves.
Who has more of an advantage? Is it the government forces or RSF?
Every Sudanese would want to see the national army. That's, I think, naturally everybody would be in support of the national army. RSF was part of the army and then rebelled against the army, and now people are supporting the army. All at the same time, there are people are supporting the RSF. So even the people right now are divided. And the war right now moved from the war between the rapid support forces and the Sudanese armed forces into civil war right now between even communities, because the rapid support forces is backed by tribes and backed by ethnicities, and that's why the army also is backed by other people. Now the fighting is actually moving not only within the military, but the war has exceeded that into the community.
VOA's Paul Ndiho was speaking to Shakur Nyaketo, a Sudanese journalist now based in Qatar. The World Bank has lowered its economic growth forecast for sub-Saharan Africa this year to 3% from 3.4%, mainly because of the destruction of Sudan's economy in its civil war. However, the bank said yesterday that growth is expected to remain comfortably above last year's 2.4% thanks to higher private consumption and investment. The Global Lender said in its latest Regional Economic Outlook report, Africa's Pulse, that it expects growth next year at 3.9%. That's above its previous forecast of 3.8%. The 18-month-long conflict in Sudan has devastated economic activity and caused starvation and widespread displacement. The World Bank said without the war, regional growth in 2024 would have been half a percentage point higher. Rwanda is vaccinating contact tracers and health workers against the Marburg virus. The United States has issued warnings against travel to Rwanda because of the virus, drawing criticism from officials at the Africa Center for Disease Control. Nambara Galion reports for VOA from Kigali.
Dr. Muyombo Thomas, the director of Regional Center for Blood Transfusion, says he has been vaccinated against the Marburg virus.
Yeah, it's something that I appreciate because being vaccinated helps me to increase my chances of not contacting the virus.
Listen, Rwanda received 700 doses of the Marburg virus vaccine from the Sabin Vaccine Institute based in the United States. The vaccine is still in the test phase and has not yet been approved for general use. More than 200 people in Rwanda have been inoculated against the Marburg virus. The focus is on medical workers and contact tracers, those who trace everyone who has been in contact with Marburg patients. During a special briefing on mpox and other health emergencies, Rwanda's Minister of Health, Dr. Sabin Nsanzimana, said his ministry is being vigilant about travel to prevent the Marburg outbreak from spreading across borders.
The government of Rwanda has put in place screening mechanisms. We have listed all contacts and we have put in electronic systems that ensure close contact was supposed in isolations, in quarantine, do not move or travel to avoid any export or transmission that may go unnoticed.
Since the outbreak was identified in late September, the United States has committed nearly $11 million to address urgent health needs in Rwanda and surrounding countries. This funding includes support for surveillance and contact tracing, infection prevention and control guidance, and exit screening at Rwanda's airport and neighboring border crossings. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently issued a level 3 travel notice for the country and said the country will begin screening travelers who have recently been in Rwanda. The U.S. says its citizens should reconsider non-essential travel to Rwanda. The Director General of Africa Center for Disease Control, Dr. Jacques Aseya, said the U.S. decision is unnecessary.
This decision is led by the United States of America regarding the Marburg outbreak in Rwanda. I challenged them. I told them this decision is unfair, is unacceptable. Let me reassure you that this decision is not evidence-based.
Since the Rwanda's first Marburg outbreak was identified last month, the Ministry of Health has recorded certain fatalities and says at the moment 58 individuals are being treated. Marburg is a viral hemorrhagic fever that spreads through contact with blood and body fluids of an infected person or animal. The World Health Organization says it is fatal in more than half of all patients. There are no specific treatments for it, nor an approved vaccine. For VOA News, I'm Nambara Galeo, reporting from Kigali.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, a Kenyan conservation group enlists former poachers to save wildlife. Find out more after the break. Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. A Kenyan conservancy is using reformed poachers to protect wildlife. Conservation authorities say the program has helped poaching, especially in northern Kenya, where some communities are known for illegal hunting. Victoria Amonga reports from Meru in Kenya.
Field Ranger Kapuna Lepale's daily patrols in Kenya's Lewa Wildlife Conservancy attest to his new life as one of the conservancy's anti-poaching unit wardens. Lepale says when he was younger, he would track these animals to kill them.
I can count between 73 and 75 of the elephants that I shot and killed. Some of those I shot just got injured. I didn't count those ones.
Lepale says he killed the elephants to sell the ivory tusks. He made about $3 a kilogram. But things changed when conservationists approached him to protect the animals instead.
I said if there is a job, then I will accept it, because I have the energy and brains, but there was nowhere to work. So they came and talked to me, and we all agreed.
Kenya's Wildlife Service says it has made progress in protecting endangered elephants and rhinos, but poaching and other human activities threaten their survival. Charles Musyoki is KWS Community Service Director. He says the service is watching how well turning poachers into rangers is working at private reserves like Lewa.
We are treating it as an experiment for now. If it's going to be successful, then we may want to really embrace it and see whether it's something that we would want to work with. If it goes the other direction, then we will abandon it.
Reformed poachers like Lepale are leading campaigns against poaching through group forums in the communities. Authorities at Lewa say the conservancy has not had cases of poaching endangered rhinos in the last 5 years, and rhino numbers grew to 268 this year from 256 last year.
And by having him on board in our team, he has assisted other rangers in his skills, because, you know, he's a little bushman. And also by being involved in poaching, he knows the tricks of the poachers. So whenever we are protecting, we try and use his tricks or his skills to make sure that we protect our wildlife.
Kenya is home to at least 36,000 elephants and nearly 2,000 rhinos. Rangers like Lepale believe reforming poachers can help protect these endangered animals. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Meru, Kenya.
President William Ruto on Friday announced Kenya's commitment to deploying 600 more police officers to Haiti. He made the announcement at a news conference with Haiti's Prime Minister, Garry Conille, in Nairobi. At least 10 countries have promised to send about 2,900 troops to participate in the Kenyan-led multinational security support, but only about 430 have deployed since the UN-authorized mission got underway in June. Nearly 400 of them from Kenya. Kenyan constitutional lawyer Paul Mwangi tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that it will be helpful to get a progress report before Kenya sends more officers to Haiti.
I think the biggest problem we'll have is that we still don't yet have a report on what happened with the mission when it went. So we've not been told whether they're successful, how they're living, how they're faring, whether they are helpful in any way. So even as we think about sending many more of our troops there, I think before we do that, we need to be given a report on how the ones that we sent are faring.
And do you think that report will come in time?
Well, I don't expect that it will come at all. It is in the nature of our politics that we are kept in the dark, and I expect that we shall be kept in the dark about this, particularly if there's any unflattering information that is expected.
The U.S. and other countries had suggested forming a U.N. peacekeeping force. That idea seems to have been set aside. What do you make of that failure to have a U.N. peacekeeping force sent to Haiti?
Eventually, that I think should be the way to go, so that our involvement in this Haitian question must be for the international community, so that we should not be appearing to be in Haiti at the bequest of some countries rather than at the request of the international community. So if the international community is not willing to commit any troops, then I think we need to rethink our stand about our involvement in that mission.
The Kenyan President Ruto has always emphasized that the troops are in Haiti to help solve the situation there. But there are those who argue that Kenya has its own problems at home and maybe is not well-placed to do that. What do you think of that?
Well, whether we send troops or not, I think that should abide to the feeling of the common Kenyan. I don't think it's a question of what our president thinks or does not think, because the troops are national troops, and the sons and the daughters of people here. They are paid for by the public fund. So whether they get involved in something like that, I think it's something that should abide to the common feeling of the Kenyan people.
That was Kenyan constitutional lawyer Paul Mwangi. He was speaking with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Nairobi. Humanitarian groups in Cameroon are visiting remote areas to mark Breast Cancer Awareness Month, encouraging women to go to hospitals for free screening and treatment. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde that breast cancer deaths are often unreported because women die at home.
J'étais dans un salon de coiffure. Mon sang a démangé. En grattant mon sang gauche, je réalise qu'il y a une masse.
30-year-old history student Emile Nadej Atangana tells a group of women and girls at the University of Yaounde One campus how she was psychologically and emotionally traumatized after being diagnosed with breast cancer.
Le 30 juin 2020, je me rends à l'hôpital.
She says most of her relatives, friends and fellow students said she would not live long and abandoned her when they learned she had been diagnosed with breast cancer in July 2020. Atangana said she started getting a glimpse of hope she could be treated when medical staff members of the Yaounde Gynecology, Obstetrics and Pediatrics Hospital told her 90% of early-stage breast cancers are curable. Cameroonian government officials and humanitarian groups say cancer survivors, such as Atangana, have been sent to towns and villages as part of activities marking Pink Month. The World Health Organization says October has been designated as the Pink Month to teach people about cancer, including early identification and signs and symptoms. 42-year-old Mesodin Gwese Agbo, a cancer survivor, is also teaching people breast cancer can be treated if diagnosed early. She says civilians should stop hiding cancer patients at home to die with the false belief that cancer cannot be treated.
You don't need to hide alone with your pain. Share it with somebody and the people will be ready to help you. I was operated, and after the operation, I've been following treatment. Until now, I am fine.
This year's theme for the month in Cameroon is no one should face breast cancer alone. And yes, no one is expected to fight breast cancer alone. Ruth Amin is a public health specialist and project manager at the Yaounde-based Lifafa Research Foundation. She says ending prejudices and sending those suspected of having breast cancer to hospitals would prevent about 60% of the more than 7,000 women diagnosed with the disease from dying because they were abandoned or got to hospitals too late.
We are calling on the men to support their spouses, to support their mothers, to support their sisters in raising awareness, in carrying them to the hospitals to be clinically examined by professionals. Women should speak up. Women should go towards those facilities to get examined, because the earlier they're being diagnosed, the easier it will be for them to be treated.
Amin spoke to VOA via messaging app from Boya, a southern commercial city, where humanitarian caravans were educating locals about breast cancer awareness Saturday. Cameroon says it has equipped all hospitals with qualified medical staff members and equipment to diagnose breast cancer. The World Health Organization estimates that Cameroon has about 20,000 new cancer cases, including breast cancers, with 65% related deaths each year. The number of cases is constantly rising, but the public health ministry does not have enough data treatment, allocation of resources, and effective cancer control, according to the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
In these last weeks of U.S. presidential campaigning, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are both trying to reach the relatively small number of voters who say they have not decided who to support. VOA correspondent Scott Sons looks at the undecideds in this election.
Some Americans are already making their choice for president, with early voting underway in many states. But there remain voters who say they are undecided between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. New York voter Mary Beth Giovaccini.
You know, I just want to see, like, I want to understand who they are. They haven't really been involved much, and they're new to the entire political climate on both sides. They come from both interesting different backgrounds, and I want to see who they are and how they represent their candidates.
Undecided voters are about 3% of the electorate, according to public opinion polls. John Johnson is a research fellow at Marquette University's law school.
For a lot of voters, they haven't started paying that much attention yet. And so I think when you come up and ask them, that's the answer they might give. Some people also in the Midwest might be reticent to tell you who they'll vote for. So there could be some of that as well.
Targeted campaigning by Harris and Trump is moving some undecided voters, says University of Massachusetts political scientist Tatiche Nteta.
The population of the undecided voter is shrinking, and it shrinks with each day. Most people are going to make up their minds before Election Day, and what's really going to matter is going to be the on-the-ground mobilization of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And in what is likely going to be an extremely close election.
Trump and Harris have different challenges in convincing undecided voters, says Brookings Institution senior fellow Darrell West.
He needs to reassure Americans that, one, he respects the rule of law, that he's not going to be crazy and chaotic if he becomes a president. She, on the other hand, is less experienced. She took positions a few years ago that were much more liberal than the policies that she's espousing now. So she has to reassure voters that it's the Kamala Harris of today that they're going to get as president.
Trump, as the better known of the candidates, has both advantages and disadvantages when it comes to undecided voters, says Johnson.
Donald Trump is a candidate running for the third time for president, so most people have strong opinions about him already. Of that sliver of people who remain undecided, just a single-digit percentage number of people, both parties are working hard to convince them to vote.
That's because those undecided voters could make the difference in close swing state races that will likely decide who wins. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
And that wraps up this Tuesday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this broadcast, head over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. And now we leave you with the song Mama by Mawa. I'm your host, Jackson Vunganyi, in Washington. On behalf of our engineer Cornelius and producer Kwame Ofori, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Haja itader shalakan haja al ana mabia der ashanita taban waratai mina na suker itageni hani sana kanana gikore kati yana mi motoro kama sekete itageni kore kore kanana gijerejere ashankede ana mawaka au kukisi kanana tala ayan itamagi numbile ashambes itader arufana numke akila ana gisa to chase away my nightmares. You always manage how to put a big smile on my face. Ita ali man geni beid mi mashaki wadila ana hajatana arufi dunya de mafi haja bitimu ana bidafa takide ana deru wadileta ana kuna kuna de.